tutti, benvenuti a questo incontro pomeridiano della Storia in Piazza. Vedo che la sala si sta ancora riempendo, quindi procederò con una certa lentezza a introdurre, ma non troppo, perché come sapete i tempi all'interno di questa manifestazione giustamente sono abbastanza contingentati. L'ospite di questo nostro incontro è particolarmente illustre, per me è un onore poterlo introdurre, lo dico da giovane studioso del Medio Oriente e dell'Islam, perché il professor Sami Zubaida è conosciuto nel nostro ambito di studi come un'autorità, e quindi è veramente un piacere poterlo avere qui a Genova, in questa sala così bella e così autorevole, potremmo dire. Bene, il tema che tratterà il professor Sami Zubaida è il proibito e il rituale, le religioni e il cibo. Ecco, io prima di lasciare a lui la parola nello svolgimento di questo tema, vorrei semplicemente presentarlo molto brevemente. Il professor Zubaida è professore emerito al Birkbeck College della London University, è anche ricercatore associato al Food Studies Center della SOAS, l'università, diciamo così, l'Università di Studi Orientali e Africani di Londra. Ha pubblicato moltissimo, ha avuto una produzione scientifica molto intensa e particolarmente numerosa sulla politica medio orientale, sulle problematiche o tematiche legate alla religione e alla legge, e anche appunto, questo particolarmente negli ultimi anni direi della sua attività, legata a quello che è il tema della Storia in Piazza, ossia al cibo nei suoi molteplici significati sociologici, politici, storici e via dicendo. Le sue pubblicazioni purtroppo, devo dire, non sono state molto tradotte in italiano, tranne un libro il cui titolo originale era Islam, the People and the State. In italiano mi pare sia stato tradotto dalla casa editrice Yakabook come Islam, la società e lo Stato. È un libro molto, molto interessante sulle idee, sui movimenti nel Medio Oriente, e quindi appunto è una lettura che consiglio a chiunque voglia approfondire quest'area, la storia, la politica di quest'area del mondo così cruciale anche in questo momento storico. Non voglio aggiungere altro, lascio la parola a Sami Zubaida, ringraziandolo ancora veramente di cuore per aver voluto essere con noi questa sera. Grazie.
Thank you very much for that kind introduction, and I'm very happy to be here on this magnificent palace, wonderful occasion in the elegant city of Genoa, and happy to be giving this lecture on the question of religious prohibitions, ritual, and food and drink. The religious food taboos that are familiar to most people in the West are the Jewish and Muslim food and drink prohibitions. Both religions prohibit pork and consider the pig an abomination, even to touch or to behold. You may also know that both religions prohibit blood and carrion, that is, dead animals, animals that have died before being slaughtered. These two, blood and carrion, are considered polluting. Both religions then prescribe procedures of slaughter and processing of meat, which require the slaughterer to cut the throat of the beast and drain the blood, thus rendering it halal for Muslims or kasher or kosher for Jews. The two, however, are not the same from the point of view of followers of the respective religions. The name of God has to be invoked at the time of the slaughter. and for the Jews a particular blessing. In its origins, this invocation of God distinguished the monotheists from pagans who sacrificed to other gods. For the Jews, halal is not kasher, nor kasher is halal for Muslims. Some Muslim authorities, however, had ruled that if halal is not obtainable, then a Muslim may eat kasher. There are many more ritual regulations, especially for the Jews. Draining the blood at slaughter is not enough. The morsels of meat must be salted, then washed to rid of any remnants of blood. Jewish prohibitions extend to combinations of genres of food, most commonly of milk or dairy products with meat. Not only can they not be combined, but hours of time must elapse between the consumption of meat and the eating of dairy products. The Hebrew Bible, in the chapters of Leviticus and Deuteronomy, does not stop at the pig when it comes to animals, but presents an extensive list of the prohibited. It presents a taxonomy of mammals, fish, and birds, which separate the licit from the illicit. Of mammals, it specifies those good to eat as the quadrupeds, which chew the cud, that is, their ruminants, and divide the hoof. This restricts the choice to typical farm animals in the Middle East, sheep, goats, and cows. It is this prescription that excludes the pig alongside other animals. Other animals excluded, the domestic ones, are the camel, which is eaten by many people of the desert, the hare, the rabbit, and all other creatures fall outside the narrow taxonomy of chewing the cud and dividing the hoof. Of wild animals, it only allows the deer. Of creatures of the water, it only allows those which have scales and fins, a prohibition shared with the Shiite Muslims, thus rejecting all other seafood, crustaceans, mollusks, and fish with no fins or obvious scales, such as eel, shark, and monkfish. The exclusion of categories of birds is not so systematically presented. Prohibited birds are named individually and seem to consist of birds of prey. Now to come to the prohibitions in the Quran. Quran, by contrast with the Hebrew Bible, the prohibitions are limited. And I quote here, "He," that's God, "has only forbidden to you dead animals, blood, and the flesh of swine, and that which has been dedicated to other than Allah." So the prohibitions in the Quran are very limited, unlike the Hebrew Bible. The prohibition of blood and dead animals entails that, to be licit, the animal has to be slaughtered and the blood drained, just like the biblical requirement, and the name of Allah pronounced at the slaughter. Although the Quran stops at these food prohibitions, we find additional forbidden foods in some later Muslim authorities, notably the Shiites, who prohibit sea creatures in similar lists to that of the Bible and the Jews. Sea animals that lack fins and scales. Some Sunni Muslims in Turkey and the Arab Levant seem to observe similar avoidances, supported by one school of Sunni law. Curiously, prawns are considered exempt by some Shiite Muslims on the grounds that their shell is scales, and by others on the assertion that prawns are the marine equivalent of locusts, and locusts are allowed. Now, this brings us to the curious episode of caviar in Iran, because, as you know, caviar comes from the sturgeon, and the sturgeon does not have scales, at least no visible scales. The criterion is that you should be able to remove the scales without cutting the skin, and you can't do that. Now, so caviar had been considered illicit by Shiite Muslims, and seeing that Iran is one of the two main producers, Iran and Russia, of caviar, this has become quite an important economic issue in Iran, because the export of caviar is lucrative trade for the country. So after the Iranian Revolution in 1979, given that the religious laws and prohibitions were enforced by the state, caviar was considered to be prohibited. Now, this, of course, was not satisfactory from an economic point of view. So a group of clerics and of fishery experts embarked on a process of systematic examination of the fish to determine its ritual status, and ultimately decided that it did have some scales around the tail end. These findings were presented to Imam Khomeini, the ultimate arbiter, who accepted them and issued a fatwa, a ruling, in 1983, declaring the fish to be licit, and the caviar trade therefore resumed, to everybody's relief. The other prohibition in Islam is that of alcohol, but it's in a different context, a different register to the prohibition of pork. The mention of wine, khamr, in the Quran is various. It's clear that wine made from fermented dates or grapes was commonly known and drunk in the Arabian milieu of early Islam. Earlier verses in the Quran praise the benefits of wine, and wine is promised to the pious in paradise. But the consensus of opinion considers later verses, which were against wine, to have overruled the earlier ones. The decisive verse is the following, and I quote, "O believers, wine and gambling, idols and divining arrows are an abhorrence, the work of Satan, so keep away from it, and you may prevail. Satan only desires to arouse discord and hatred among you with wine and gambling, and to deter you from the mention of God and from prayer." End of quote. It's interesting to note that the context of the prohibition here is one of social order, together with gambling and divination, and distinct from the verses elsewhere which prohibit pork, pork blood and carrion, on the basis, on the context of purity. So whereas these meats are polluting, wine is prohibited because it causes trouble. This social order focus has a significance for later permissive interpretations, because while Muslims generally don't eat pork, don't really like pork, or they don't know whether they like it or not, they find it abhorrent, that's not their attitude to wine, because many Muslims, of course, historically and to the present, do drink alcohol. But some of the sort of elite Muslims said that the prohibition only applied to the common people who make trouble and who cannot control themselves, and it's not meant for the elites who know how to drink and can control themselves. Now, how do we explain these prohibitions? Why are these foods prohibited? The Bible's own explanation of the prohibition of various meats is for the Lord to declare, and I quote, "I, the Lord, am your God, and has set you apart from other peoples." He's addressing the people of Israel. "So you shall set apart the pure quadruplets from the impure, the impure bird from the pure. You shall not draw abomination upon yourselves through quadruped or bird or anything with which the ground is alive, which I have set apart for you as impure. You shall be holy to me, for I, the Lord, am holy, and I have set you apart from other people to be mine. End of quote. So it's quite clear that here it's a question of holiness, of purity, of wholeness, and that is almost a kind of a symbol for the people of Israel, set apart from other people, and these are the one of the criteria of setting them apart. Israel is the Lord's chosen people, and to retain that status, they must obey his laws and worship only him. This has the logic of cohesion through worship. For the worship of the one God and obedience to his law. But it does not explain why some things are pure and others abominable. It is arbitrary declaration. This has set commentators and analysts over the centuries guessing and seeking explanation. Many of these concern the pig. Maimonides, the Jewish theologian of the 12th century who lived in Muslim Spain and then in Egypt and was the doctor to Saladin, the famous Muslim warrior. Maimonides attributed the rejection of the pig to its obvious dirty habits of following in dirt and eating garbage and even feces. He also contended that the pig has disgusting sexual habits. This was a common explanation in terms of dirt and reprehensible conduct for both Jews and Muslims to the present day. Maimonides also interpreted the dietary rules in general as being avenues of discipline and piety, binding the believer to God's commands, as indeed is explicitly stated in the Bible. This emphasis on discipline and self-denial was given another twist by some early Greek Christians who opined that pork was forbidden because it was too delicious and a rich meat, and the believers were being protected from temptations of overindulgence and of sexual appetite. With the turn in scientific thought since early modernity, speculation turned to questions of health and hygiene, then to ecological explanations, and later for the structuralist anthropologists in terms of the logic of categories. Medical speculations regarding the association of undercooked pork with trichinosis, you know, the worms, started in mid-19th century and became the most popular and common sense explanation to the present time. To that extent, even some liberal Jews decided that now we know the reason for the prohibition, and now we have modern facilities of refrigeration, it is safe to eat pork when fully cooked. Scholarly opinion mostly rejected the health explanation for a number of objections. Such medical knowledge, it's argued, was not available at the compilation of the Bible. And for believers, God will have known, of course, if it was bad for you, but why did he not declare the reason for that, and why not forbid so many other harmful foods? He never said, be careful what mushrooms you eat, for instance. Besides, it is not only the pig that was forbidden, but a whole array of other animals, as we saw. One may add that the pig-eating regions in Europe and Asia are not less healthy or prone to disease than the pig-forbidden regions. Particular anthropologists and archaeologists, one for instance, Martin Harris, advanced explanations in terms of ecological conditions of the region of the Middle East. Cattle, sheep, and goats, the ruminants, are perfectly suited to arid farming conditions. They eat fodder which cannot be ingested by humans, grasses and weeds, highly fibrous, which they can only digest because they are ruminants. As such, they do not compete with humans for scarce food. They also sweat to cool their bodies under hot, arid conditions. With sparse cover of vegetation, the pig is the opposite. It does not sweat, not much, and is in constant need of hydration, hence rolling itself in the mud and dirt when fresh water is not to hand. It thrives in forested areas for food and shade, and its fodder is of the same genre as human food, fruit, vegetables, and nuts, and only eats excrement when nothing else is available, much like chickens. For those reasons, the argument goes, pig avoidance was widely shared in the region, not just the Israelites. This explanation also begs the question, if the pig is not suitable for ecological reasons, would it not be rejected or avoided in any case for instrumental reasons? Why did it need divine sanction? A widely favored explanation is in terms of the purity of categories advanced by structural anthropologists since the 1960s, following Claude Lévi-Strauss' structural anthropology, the main exponent being the British anthropologist Mary Douglas in her classic book Purity and Danger in 1966. The ruminants are the perfect category of farm animals as specified in Genesis, the ones sanctioned for sacrifice at the temple. Holiness, in the biblical usage, she argued, is wholeness and purity of categories without mixing and hybridity. Farm animals are part of the land which had been blessed by God, part of the covenant. They are clean for sacrifice. To quote, by rules of avoidance, holiness was given a physical expression in every encounter with the animal kingdom and at every meal. Observance is then part of worship. Douglas went on to examine the other prohibitions and primarily finds cleanliness and the purity of the categories. Creatures of the air, the water, and the land, fish which swim with fins and have the attributes of the perfect fish, rejections of creatures that are not wholly of the water or the earth, but slither between, like reptiles, and so on. Some have found this explanation circular, the criteria of holiness, perfection, arising from the very text that then declare some creatures pure and others not. Yet this seems to be the most satisfactory approach in conformity with the religious logic of purity, holiness, and discipline. Now we come to the operation of these rules in relation to social relations and social situation. So, do these rules, obviously, one of their consequences that they establish social boundaries between the Jews, Muslims, and other people who don't observe these prohibitions. The Bible states that the purity laws were part of God's special covenant with Israel and set them apart from the other people. In fact, the dietary prescriptions did not differentiate the Israelites from their neighbors, who were also pastoralists and farmers, who ate similar diets and not much meat, and the pig was not on the menu. It did not stop biblical characters from sharing meals with their neighbors. So we see Joseph's brothers in the Old Testament eating Egyptian food, and Esther in the book of Esther partaking in Persian banquets, and many other examples of commensality with non-Israelites. It is in the subsequent history of Judaism and of Islam that we find interpretations of the dietary laws which enforce social boundaries on commensality in various patterns. Rabbinical, then Talmudic, elaborations instituted many boundaries restricting or forbidding eating and drinking with outsiders, such as the rules on wine, which forbid drinking what has been produced or even touched by a non-Jew. The logic of the prohibition is that wine may have been used for libation to foreign gods, and the mere contact of the wine with a foreigner opens up the possibility of libation. Rabbinical casuistry considered the question, if the foreigner is a newborn child touching the wine accidentally, that rules out the possibility of libations. Even then, argued the rabbis, the wine should not be drunk by a Jew, but can be sold to foreigners. Over the long history of Judaism, there have been many patterns of diet and commensality following the logic of social relations and circumstances. But there is no doubt that strict observance uniformly acts as a social boundary between Jews and their neighbors. What about Muslims and social boundaries? For Sunni Muslims, there is no systematic doctrinal barrier to commensality with non-Muslims within the bounds of permitted foods. That is not the case for the Shiite Muslims, who consider non-Muslims to be a source of impurity and pollution. I remember once, that's a personal story, as a boy traveling in the countryside in Iraq, and in a car with my uncle, and stopping at a roadside cafe to drink a glass of tea. And the roadside cafe had a big pot of water with a metal cup, so people could take water from the container and drink it. And one man took water from the container and drank half of it and then put it back in the container. And so somebody who was hygienically minded objected to the cafe owner. I said, did you see what that man did? He drank some of the water and put it back. And the cafe owner looked in askance at the complainant and said, why, is he not a Muslim? So the idea that if it's a Muslim putting water back and then it's okay, if it was not a Muslim, then it would be forbidden. Now, where were we? Some Shia houses have a ritual pond or pool in the house in which they rinse all food implements that come from outside for purification. Commensality with non-Muslim, then, is excluded. However, there is room for innovation in Shia practice. Every Shia believer follows a chosen religious authority, a marja. And in more recent times, there have been some liberal and modernist marjas who have ruled against the avoidance of non-Muslims. A notable figure in this was the late Sheikh Fadlallah from Lebanon, who always ruled on the liberal side, and who also ruled against the taboo on seafood. Alcohol has been another marker of social boundaries for Muslim, to which I shall turn presently. What about Christians? In the early years of Christianity, many followers of Christ continued to observe Jewish prohibitions. But the later universalization of Christianity beyond its Jewish origins led to the abandonment and even the rejection of the food rituals, the prohibitions in the Hebrew Bible being considered allegorical and not binding. Some Christian authorities from Hellenistic times to medieval times and even early modern forbade commensality with Jews because of the infidelity of Jews and their enmity to Christ and their own rejection of the food of Christians. Now I come to alcohol. The prohibition of alcohol in Islam may act as a social boundary, not only between Muslims and others, but within Muslim communities. The prohibition is widely bypassed by many Muslims, historically and to the present. In fact, the Arabic and Persian literature and Turkish literature from early times on is full of poetry and essays which celebrate wine and drink, and even in context of mystical religion of the Sufis. Now, we saw that the prohibition of alcohol occurs in a different context in the Quran from that of pork, blood, and carrion. Those latter are prohibited as impure pollutants, while alcohol is banned to preserve social order against the disruptive plans of Satan, together with gambling and divination. Muslims, like many Jews, may have a visceral revulsion against pork, but are much more tolerant of alcohol. Wine was and is widely taken by social elites, royal courts, and even religious notables, some justifying their infraction by invoking the social order context. The prohibition is only for the common people who get drunk and disorderly, but not for the elite who know how to drink. Some in the lower orders also drunk, especially the soldiers, who, like the Ottoman Janissaries, had their own taverns, entertainments, and drinking cultures. The authorities were occasionally cracked down on taverns as well as on coffee houses when they came into being, mostly because they were avenues of uncontrolled assembly and sociability. The Ottoman Sultan Murad IV in the 17th century forbade wine, coffee, and tobacco on pain of death, while he himself was a famous drinker. In fact, his nickname was Murad the Sot. It is related that on one occasion he wandered through Istanbul in disguise. On a boat trip across the Bosphorus, he noticed the boatman taking swigs from a bottle and asked to taste. On finding that it was wine, he shouted angrily at the man, "You are disobeying my orders." And the man said, "And who are you?" And the Sultan replied, "I am the Sultan," at which the boatman responded mockingly, "One swig and you think you are the Sultan." With the rise of the secular intelligentsia in the 19th century, drinking in Istanbul and the main Ottoman cities came into the open and was seen as a sign of modernity and civilization. Sophisticated taverns and cafes came into existence, catering for those new elites, the professionals, the educated, the bureaucratic elites of the state. They catered for them with a repertoire of not only wine and rakı, but of mezze, the things that they eat with the drinks, and with tobacco in water pipes, in nargile. It was, of course, an entirely male culture. It is with the emergence of the secular sphere that alcohol became an emblem in identity politics, marking the boundaries between the pious and conservative on the one side and the socio-political groups who were secular, of the secular liberal classes. This continues to be the case to the present time, in fact, more so the present time than ever before, and plays an important part in the culture wars in modern Turkey and elsewhere. The globalized world of media, culture, and politics has, if anything, sharpened the discourses of identity and difference. Alcohol plays an emblematic part in these discourses between observant Muslims and others, especially in the West, but also within Muslims, between classes and cultures. Similarly, food rituals, pig avoidance, halal and kosher adherence have all come to play a central part in the performance of identity, especially in the secularized societies in the West. Thank you.
Bene, grazie, molte grazie a Sami Zubaida. Io così in questa relazione, in questo discorso molto approfondito in cui ci ha aiutato, direi andare un po' oltre quella che è la percezione talvolta folcloristica, diciamo, che abbiamo dei tabù alimentari delle diverse religioni, in quello che è un problema, direi, una questione, una tematica che poi voglio dire, si pone in termini molto concreti nelle nostre società che stanno, io penso particolarmente all'Italia, che è una società, diciamo, che è divenuta, che è ritornata multietnica in età più tarda rispetto ad altri paesi europei. Queste tematiche, ossia le diversità culturali, e anche in questo, proprio in questo senso, i tabù alimentari delle diverse religioni e le barriere sociali, i confini sociali che da essi possono scaturire, sono problematiche con cui poi ci si confronta, direi, in situazioni molto concrete. Io posso dire, da padre ad esempio, tutta quella che è la problematica nelle mense scolastiche di permettere a tutti i bambini di rispettare i precetti della religione dei loro genitori, senza far sì che questo però produca segregazione, senza che questo produca divisioni all'interno delle classi, no? Quindi, dicevo, piccoli problemi concreti che però in un'epoca in cui, come diceva il professor Zubaida, si tendono ad enfatizzare e direi a drammatizzare in tanti casi le differenze, sembrano talvolta problemi insolubili. Quindi grazie per questo discorso che, come dire, ci ha permesso, attraverso la conoscenza, attraverso la, diciamo così, decostruzione storica e sociologica di questi precetti, anche di capirne le ragioni e gli effetti a livello sociale. Direi che forse possiamo concludere qui, anche perché siamo leggermente in anticipo e forse può essere l'occasione per tutti. Sì, annuncio lei. Può essere l'occasione per tutti per prendersi un caffè, che non mi risulta sia proibito questo in nessuna cultura, tantomeno in quella italiana. Volevo solo ricordarvi appunto i due appuntamenti che seguiranno alle 16, l'incontro con Lucio Caracciolo, 7 miliardi a tavola nella sala del Minor Consiglio, e nella sala dell'Archivio Storico con Gabriella Turnaturi, La seduzione vi è mangiando. E quindi potremmo dire, e mi sembra opportuno in questo caso, un piatto ricco a cui possiamo partecipare. Grazie.